Good morning, everyone. Good morning and welcome. Grab a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and make yourselves comfortable. Welcome to the Kennedy Center Developmental Disability Grand Rounds. For those of you that attend regularly, you know that we have a sign-up sheet in the back if you need to earn CMEs or APA or continuing ed credits. If you are signing up for continuing education credits, you also need to fill out an evaluation form and leave it with Amy or at the back of the room as you leave. And we would also ask that all of you please fill out an evaluation form about the program this morning so that we can better serve you in the months and years ahead. So for those of you that come regularly, you'll notice that we have a new sign. It used to say 40 years, and talk about fast work. We talked yesterday at our admin meeting about updating the sign, and it is updated to reflect now that we're 45 years, okay? So I just had to point that out because I'm so proud. So putting that aside, it is my absolute pleasure to introduce Dr. Greg Stanwood to you this morning. Most all of you in the room already know Greg, but he is an extremely well-accomplished assistant professor currently in the Department of Pharmacology. Greg graduated from Temple University in Philadelphia. He earned his bachelor's there in biology and psychology, and I didn't know about that dual major with psychology, Greg. He graduated summa cum laude, and he went on to get his PhD in neuroscience from the University of Pennsylvania. He then did a postdoctoral training experience at the University of Pittsburgh, where he met up with the likes of Dr. Pat Levitt. And we were very fortunate to recruit Greg and Beth Ann to Vanderbilt when Pat came in 2002. Greg has a ton of publications. All of them, just about all of them, have the word dopamine in them. And I think almost all of them, I counted. And we are in for a treat this morning when we hear about dopaminergic modulation of brain development and behavior. But before Greg comes up, there are two additional things I need to say about Greg that aren't in his bio sketch. No, they're all good. One is that he has played an absolutely positively pivotal and leadership role in the development of our neurobehavioral core. If you haven't been over to that animal facility, you need to go and see it. When I took the tour there, it almost made me want to become a mouse researcher. It is elegant and it is beautiful, and it really reflects on Greg's leadership in pulling that amazing facility together. The second thing about Greg that we all appreciate is that you are truly a team player. So when we have here at the Kennedy Center a lunch and learn or a leadership council meeting, we invariably ask Beth Ann or Greg to please come and explain science in ways that are accessible to people that aren't scientists. And you have been so gracious in doing that, and we really appreciate that very much. So welcome, Greg, and I am very much looking forward to your talk.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. A really wonderful introduction. I really appreciate the sentiment. And so I guess my goal for the next few years is to get that almost removed from the almost want to do mouse behavior. Well, we'll work on that. It really is a pleasure to be able to give Grand Rounds this morning. Thanks to you all for coming. I really appreciate it. The Kennedy Center is a huge part of both scientific and personal life for both Beth Ann and myself. We both feel really fortunate to be part of the center, and it's helped each of our sciences amazingly since we've been down here.
Can you move your mic down the
road? Is that okay? See, the beauty is I like to roam, so Tony put me on this mic. If Beth Ann had her way, I would be duct taped to here. So if I roam too much, you know, I'll get some angry stares from there, but other people can give polite waves. So I'm going to talk to you today about work that I actually initiated during my postdoctoral fellowship with Pat Levitt at the University of Pittsburgh, that Pat and I continued collaboratively here at Vanderbilt, and that my lab is now continuing to explore. I've had an independent laboratory for going on about 2 years now, and we're following up some of the interesting observations we've made. The focus of the lab is truly on developmental roles for classical neurotransmitters. Systems, neurochemicals, we know a fair amount about how they operate in the adult nervous system, and we've known forever, well, not forever, but for 50 or so years that they become expressed very early in development, but it's only very recently that we've had some model systems where we can look at that. And we're gonna focus on, although my lab primarily works on the dopamine system, not exclusively, although I definitely notice that the publication list reflects that, but we're gonna focus on that today. And for those of you that know South Park at all, one of the sub-themes is going to be that drugs are bad. So human brain development, as everyone in the room knows, is very protracted. This slide simply demonstrates what's going on in the development of the brain during in utero development. Of course, this continues long after birth through adolescence. But the studies in our group really look at what's happening early, particularly during prenatal development. And the key point, again, is that each neurotransmitter system, each neurotransmitter system has a unique spatial and temporal pattern of onset during brain development. And again, this is before we have functional synapses. Functional synapses actually occur relatively late in development. Synapses meaning that the tight junctions where chemical communication is occurring between cells. So we think of this as these molecules having pleiotropic biological activities. Pleiotropy is a term that's most often used in genetics to relate to multiple functions for a gene. We're using it more at a functional, protein functional state, but there are pleiotropic biological activities. And the general idea is that early in development, these systems are still modulating information flow. So in the adult nervous system, particularly the systems we're going to focus on, biogenic amines, they're modulating fast excitatory and inhibitory transmission. They're sort of giving the temporal characteristics of the communication. And early in development, they're doing the same type of modulatory actions, but at these times, the decision of a cell, of a neuron, isn't whether or not you fire an action potential. Again, synapses aren't there. But it's the other relevant questions that a cell is encountering at that time. Do I continue to, if I'm a progenitor cell, do I continue to divide into more cells to sort of seed the nervous system? Or do I go through a terminal differentiation and make a decision to become a neuron? And if so, what flavor of neuron? It's more than 31 flavors of Baskin-Robbins when you're talking about the development of neurons. How should I get there? Again, most cells in the nervous system don't live where they're born. They have to move somewhere along the way. And then who do I eventually connect with? And the overarching hypothesis of our lab is that alterations in these systems alters neurodevelopmental trajectory, and it can be in very specific ways. Okay, and that's based, again, on the spatial patterns and the timing of when these systems come online. And we think that contributes to the developmental basis of mental health illnesses. This still sounds like I'm getting feedback. Should I move it down? You want me to take it off? It's a small group. Let me swing this in. Can everybody hear me? I'll just talk loud. I don't usually have a problem with that.
Greg, you need to talk
in the mic, so yes. Oh, I got it. Famous or infamous? And so particular sensitivity to insult on these systems occurs during the initial period when each of these systems is coming online. So again, the timing is key, and what we think of is that the brain is becoming wired to the needs of the environment. So what happens when the environment during these critical developmental periods is not actually representative of the norm? So for today's talk, we're going to focus on these modulatory systems. You don't have to worry about the details of this slide. I just use it as an example of all the various systems that are being interplayed during prenatal development. And we've just got some general time points here for human development. for mouse development. Most of what, all that I'm going to talk about today, I'm a basic scientist, all that I'm going to talk about today is derived from animal models. And generally, the type of neurodevelopmental events that are occurring during development, starting with very early stages of migrating to where the cells are going to end up going through, some transient projections, the eventual establishment of sort of the beginnings of topography, of circuitry, and then ending in final synaptogenesis and local tuning of these circuits. And there are very specific neurotransmitter systems that are involved in each of these stages. And in particular today, we're going to focus on the dopamine system. This is a cartoon of a sagittal section through a rodent brain. So this is, you know, with me looking sideways, this is as if we made a section right down the midline, exposed one side of the hemisphere. If we start with the adult, this is the front of the brain, this is the back, the cerebellum, the cerebral cortex. The majority of the dopamine-containing cell bodies are in the midbrain. I apologize. I keep hitting that button. I'm going to stop using it. Are in the midbrain, and they project in very specific patterns to these four brain areas. In particular, for the focus of today, we're going to concentrate on two areas that receive prominent dopaminergic innervations. One is the cerebral cortex. That innervation derives from the so-called A10 cell group, or the cells in the ventral tegmental area. This is thought of as the mesolimbic, mesocortical dopamine system, very involved in reward systems, variety of other functions. And it doesn't project throughout the cerebral cortex. It actually projects to very specific areas of the cerebral cortex, such as the medial frontal cortex, areas involved in attentional regulation, executive function. The other primary region we're going to focus on today is the striatum, a major component of the basal ganglia. The dopaminergic projection to the striatum is the pathway that degenerates in Parkinson's disease and produces a number of motor impairments. This originates from the A9 substantia nigra area, and again, it's predominantly subcortical in its projections. But these cells exist very early in development, extremely early. This is a similar section, but through an embryonic sort of the equivalent of late first trimester in a mouse. And you can see that the cell bodies are there, and the pathways aren't described, but actually these axons to innervate these target regions develop very quickly after the cells are first born. So that very early in prenatal development, you actually have these afferents from the midbrain containing dopamine, releasing dopamine, and they can stimulate these target regions. So we're going to be focusing not on the dopamine-containing cell bodies for the purposes of what I'm going to talk today, but on these target regions, the striatum and the cortex. And we're going to talk about some developmental roles for dopamine in developing that brain architecture. One of the model systems that we've worked on a lot in the lab, and this is work that I initiated when I was a postdoc in Pat Levitt's lab, is work on gestational models of cocaine exposure. Here's an example of a dopaminergic synapse. So the neurotransmitter dopamine is synthesized by the amino acid tyrosine through the actions of some very important selective enzymes for these particular cells. Dopamine is packaged into vesicles in the adult nervous system. You would get an action potential, depolarization of this terminal, release of dopamine into this synaptic space. Following release into the synaptic space, the transmitter activates specific receptors on the next cell on the circuit, the postsynaptic cell. There's also some receptors presynaptically. The important thing is this signal needs to be cleared. So for neurons to communicate with one another in the nervous system, you need to have a system by which you can turn off that signaling fast so it's just not constantly there. In the dopamine system, the way this is primarily accomplished is by dopamine being taken back up into the presynaptic cells by high-affinity transporter proteins. the so-called dopamine transporter, which I'm schematizing here. So that would be the way that it gets inactivated. Lo and behold, if you take the drug cocaine or some other abuse substances, they can also bind to this transporter. In the case of cocaine, it basically works as an antagonist at the transporter for the endogenous ligand dopamine. So the net effect of this is to increase the amount of extracellular dopamine and to reduce its clearance rate. Cocaine actually happens to be a very dirty drug. It also affects norepinephrine and serotonin systems. I won't get into the details of it for the purposes of today, but for whatever reason, with prenatal cocaine exposure at sort of recreational dose levels, it looks as though it truly is dopamine system that's mediating most of these effects in the dopamine transporter. So why are we interested in this clinically? Well, although it's not quite the problem it was 15 or 20 years ago, overall, statistics show that about 1% of mothers have used cocaine during pregnancy. And in the mid-80s, during the true epidemic, there were some populations where incidence rates were up to 20%, and the overall was 3 to 5%. I mean, that's an amazing number of kids that were born during that time and are still growing up. Even today, there's about 12,000 new births of in utero cocaine-exposed children each year. So what does this mean, though, in terms of what's going on with the kids? The first thing I really want to make clear from the get-go is, you know, the Time and Newsweek covers from the late 80s of the crack baby. That was pretty misleading in a way. It was sort of we as scientists responding to what we saw as sort of the worst-case scenario. And there were some very isolated cases where children were in very bad shape when they were born. The mothers were using cocaine and often crack during pregnancy, but they were using a variety of other drugs and illicit substances as well, and there were a lot of things going wrong with those kids. The population that is much more prevalent and that we've been attempting to model and to work through is more what happens with moderate use, recreational use. These are mothers that are cocaine users, are addicted to the drug. However, after finding that they are pregnant, of course, they are pregnant for some time before they discover they're pregnant. But once they discover that they're pregnant, they are very motivated to reduce or completely eliminate their drug use patterns. And most of these women, and certainly by the third trimester, many of them are able to quit entirely. And really do a nice job. There's very good therapeutic interventions that can be used. Nevertheless, there has been significant first and second trimester exposure in their offspring. And the overall, so there are several cohorts, and one's in Pittsburgh, actually run by Gail Richardson, Linda Mays at Yale, Singer and others at Case Western, actually the group that Julian Noland worked at before she joined us here at the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center, have done a tremendous job of, they had prospectively recruited mothers into studies and continue to study those families and the offspring through a variety of behavioral screenings, imaging studies. Truly amazing the amount of retention rates they've had. These kids are now in their late teenage years, and they've been able to convince them to keep coming back into the clinics and to have testing. The overall pattern that we see is really in the attentiveness function and executive function. So, you know, again, at birth, these kids look no different than anyone else. The Apgar score is completely normal. I mean, you in the NICU or in the standard wards, I mean, you just don't see anything different about these kids. It's around school age when trouble starts to occur. There can be language delays. There's definitely issues within the classroom. There's working memory problems that emerge. And the idea is that it's once the circuitry that's responsible for bringing together some more complex types of learning, that's when these prodromal deficits that were sort of always there, but the circuit was never being asked to do things that are complicated enough to to show the deficit. And so that's when we start to see the behavioral deficit. So what we think is we're getting insights into, that may sound familiar to many of you. This is the same sort of idea that many of us have in thinking about the development of mental illness, schizophrenia in particular, that there are developmental insults that occur quite early. However, the symptomology of the disorder requires some additional trigger later in life. And then that sort of brings it all together. And that's the way that we, and particularly the clinical researchers working on this population, are thinking about these problems. And of course, you know, a huge problem with following these kids, even in the best controlled studies, is that you have to control for polydrug use, prenatal care, nutrition, postnatal environment, everything. It makes it very difficult to establish causality within these populations in particular, where very few people will only be administering cocaine. If you're using cocaine, you're probably using a variety of other drugs as well. There are many hundreds of papers that have characterized these groups, and the literature has been very controversial at times. But here's a really nice sort of summary of some of the data that's come out of the Case Western cohort. We're looking specifically at perceptual reasoning IQ versus comparing no cocaine exposure. So these are kids that were exposed potentially to other drugs in utero, but cocaine not among them. What they just classify as light cocaine exposure. This is done by self-report. They do also take hair samples, meconium samples at birth to try to gauge how much cocaine was actually used during the pregnancy. And then versus heavier cocaine exposure, and you can see, you know, a rough dose-related decline in perceptual reasoning IQ, but we're talking about 5 points. I mean, so do we really worry about 5 points in IQ overall in a population? You know, some people have looked at these data and said, so what? 5 points, that's pretty subtle. Well, this is a figure I really like that Ted Slotkin put together in a review years and years ago, and I'm always surprised that more people haven't sort of adopted this model to look at it. And so we don't really know with the prenatal drug abuse if it still is a normal population in terms of the distribution of the data for IQ. But here's just some theoretical data modeling, you know. So what happens if you see a loss of 5 IQ points? So if you go from, you know, this middle range, if you go from, you know, an IQ of 100 to 95, that's probably not even a noticeable difference in how a child is developing, doing, being able to move through. But what you really have to worry about are these tails of the distribution. So on the high functioning side, you know, so in this case, Ted's defining as 3 standard deviations off from the mean as the true tails. So if you look out here with, you know, the typical mean of 100, you know, you're going to have a very small percentage of folks that are here in this highly gifted, very high functioning area. And you're going to see a sharp reduction of folks in that area. And perhaps even more importantly, those numbers are going to be made up on this side of the distribution. And so you're looking at a threefold increase in true low functioning, what, you know, 20 years ago we would have termed as retarded or, you know, severely developmentally impaired, delayed in that classification. So it's not the crack baby syndrome, but this is something that is affecting hundreds of thousands of children in the United States alone. So now I'm going to get a little bit into the data. And we started a few minutes late, so I'm going to skip some of the data slides that I have. But I do want to lay out the model and why we use the model. It's very atypical. You can see here some of the work I'm going to talk to you about is in rabbits. And I always get groans from my basic science colleagues of, you know, why would you ever work in a rabbit? You know, everyone likes mice, or, you know, if you really want to get into genetics, model systems for that. Why a rabbit? Well, the reason why a rabbit for this is the pharmacology. So cocaine is one of those drugs where route of administration is just so crucial in the actions. And when humans use cocaine, you're talking about inhaling it, smoking it, injecting it. You're talking about routes of administration that you're going to get a fast rush into the brain and very fast clearance. And it's actually fairly difficult to do that in rodent models. You have to insert a catheter, keep it patent, and we're doing these things in a developmental context. It's very, very challenging. Rabbits, on the other hand, have these huge ears with these beautiful veins that you can just take a pediatric butterfly needle and insert day after day after day with incredibly minimal stress on the animals, and repeatedly give deliberate timing and doses of injections. So just very briefly, in terms of just to sort of orient you, rabbits have 30 days gestation. So for those of you that work in mice, we're talking 20 days in mice. It's a little bit more protracted, but obviously much more condensed than what we see in primates. Postnatally, their eyes open about 10 days of age. They typically get weaned at about 7 weeks of age. And I will keep wanting to hit that left button. I apologize. They typically get weaned at 7 weeks of age, and they're truly, we have 60 plus here. It's probably more like about 120 days is when they truly become adult animals. And so originally when we set up the model, we just tried to basically, we did the hammer experiment, use as high of a dose as we thought we could manage and give it for as long a period during gestation as we thought was relevant. But we, after seeing, and I'll show you some of those effects, but after doing that a number of times, we were able to make some hypotheses about when during prenatal development would be most crucial. And in fact, we identified we don't call it a critical period because we're not absolutely sure that it's critical exactly in this exact day range, but we hedge a little bit and we call it a sensitive period. And so the sensitive period I'm going to tell you about is from day 16 to 25. And I'll show you why it makes sense that this is really a sensitive period in producing changes. So I basically have told you this, that the lack of the catheter. We actually know a lot from previous studies of development of the rabbit brain. So it's a very beautiful organism, very nice lamination patterns, actually much better than you get in rodent models. So there's some other advantages, and stereotypes are often true. And if you're doing a developmental study, it helps to have a lot of progeny. So here's a study that we actually just did recently, although we had been thinking about it for years and years and years, and just to show pharmacokinetically that we truly are modeling what we intend to model. The dose we typically use now is 3 mg/kg. We give it twice a day during the sensitive period. This is an experiment where we gave cocaine intravenously through the ear vein that we always use, but we had implanted a catheter into their carotid artery that we could do blood sampling from, so we could actually measure how quickly the cocaine went in to the bloodstream and then was cleared. And you can see, the time scale here is just out to 10 minutes. So you can see this incredibly rapid peak. So it's already at maximal concentrations within 30 seconds after injection. And this was incredibly relevant for us because here's one of the few studies that's ever been done in people. I'm not sure how much success we'd have these days with the IRB to get permission to do this type of study, but this is where human patients were brought into a clinic and administered various concentrations. In this case, it's showing 16 and 32. 16 milligrams for a person is right at that recreational dose level that you would expect people to be using fairly routinely, and you can see that the peak levels right here, they're different scales, but it comes out right about the same time. And you can see, again, it's a very quick withdrawal from it, or with degradation of it. So I won't go through all the data for it. Overall, we don't see major teratology in the animal model that we've been looking at. Innervation patterns of the cortex and striatum of biogenic immune systems is all normal. Cortical lamination patterns, the offspring grow up just fine. But following the approach that I was always taught as a graduate student of, you know, tell people what you're going to tell them, then tell them, and then tell them again. This is really the, I'll show you some of the raw data, but this is the slide I'd like you to remember something of in terms of what the effects of prenatal cocaine are. So looking for example at the cortex, and here we're looking specifically at the anterior cingulate cortex, a medial frontal region of the brain that receives a dense dopamine innervation from the ventral tegmental area that occurs developmentally and persists through adulthood. And also from the striatum, this basal ganglia region, is in the cortex, we see these very intriguing changes in brain architecture. We see changes specifically in these processes that the cells of the cortical neurons extend. In a brain, this cell body would be relatively deep in the cerebral cortex, and this process would go out to the surface. It goes out to the apical surface, so we call it an apical dendrite. This is where a lot of the synaptic contacts onto this neuron are being made. And typically in these areas of the brain, these apical dendrites just line up in this beautiful straight orientation. I mean, we think of them as soldiers in formation, just lined up all in a row. It's really stunning if you look at labeled material and you see how incredibly well organized it is. And this organization is severely lost in the animals who receive cocaine in utero. Instead, these processes basically go all over the place. They still make it to the apical surface. And the apical surface is still the same distance away two-dimensionally because there's no change in cortical thickness or number of cells or packing density. But these processes are actually 50 or 60% longer than usual because they just sort of go all over the place as they're going there. Similarly, these are glutamatergic cells of the cortex. These project to other areas of cortex or project subcortically. The other major type of neuron in the cortex are inhibitory interneurons that use GABA as their neurotransmitter. And we also see changes in a very specific subtype of GABAergic interneurons. They're these so-called fast-spiking interneurons that are very involved in the balance of excitation and inhibition within the cortex. They express a calcium-binding protein called parvalbumin that we can use as a marker of them. And we see very robust changes in the structure of those cells, but not other types of interneurons. Biochemically, we've related, and this is where the dopamine system really comes in. There are 5 different receptors for dopamine. We are not very creative, so we call them D1 through D5. D1 and D5 are actually very similar to one another in structure, sequence, pharmacology. D2, D3, D4, very similar to one another. We see very specific changes only in the D1 receptors, and we've actually looked at other neurotransmitter receptors. We've looked at serotonin receptors, acetylcholine receptors, norepinephrine receptors, and we see changes in no other receptor. And what we see with it is actually the cells of the cocaine-exposed offspring continue to make these receptors. But we found relatively early in characterizing the model that the receptors don't signal properly. And so we weren't sure why that was. And one of the things that we discovered relatively recently, and I can show you data from it, is that these receptors, the problem is the receptor. The receptor no longer makes it to the right part of the cell. Usually these sit in the plasma membrane. Again, the neurochemical dopamine is on the extracellular side, so there's a binding site for dopamine extracellularly. And then there's a bunch of intracellular proteins that these receptors need to be able to bind to intracellularly to have their signal transduction cascades. But these receptors no longer make it to the plasma membrane. They're stuck inside the cell, so they can't sense dopamine levels outside the cell. And then we also see behavioral outcomes, including some cognitive and attentional deficits and some motor deficits. So I'm going to skip this and go right to this one. Let me make it a little darker. This is an experiment where we've retrogradely filled these dendrites in the cortex. I'm going to really drive Tony crazy, and I'm going to turn off lights. I can see him getting ready to tick. What we do is, so one of the things we take advantage of is these projection neurons in the cerebral cortex have long axons that group together in bundles to go to other parts of the brain. And so we can take advantage of that experimentally. So what we can do is isolate the part of the brain where these axons are running through. And we can stick a piece of dye there. It's a lipophilic dye. It binds to membranes. It's called dye-I. And it looks red when you look at it under a fluorescent microscope. What dye-I does is it incorporates into the membranes, and it just passively moves along them. So it allows you to retrogradely label the entire cell that's picked up the dye-I. So we've done that. You know, you can't see it. It would be... let's see. So this is the pial surface, the surface of the brain. This is the deep layer of the cortex. The actual dye injection would be like in Jan Rosemary's office at this scale. Is that right? You're over there, right? Okay. And so you can see these cell bodies that pick up the dye, and more lightly stained, you can see these apical dendrites going off towards the pial surface. So we've done this in thick slabs of brain, and then we've gone back and we've cut very thin sections through, and we've gone onto a confocal microscope. A confocal microscope lets you take these very sharp, thin images and basically lay them on top of one another and eventually make a three-dimensional reconstruction of what it is that you're looking at. But in two dimensions, you know, if you make these very, very tiny changes in what we call the Z-plane going through on the confocal microscope, you can reconstruct these entire apical dendrites with just very small variations from a control animal. But in an in utero cocaine-exposed animal, that's no longer the case. So if you take this cell, you can see this part of the dendrite here, but then we've got to jag all the way up to here to see this part. Then we've got to jag all the way back through this way to make up this part, and then it eventually comes back to the pial surface there. So we call these the wavy dendrites. They're sort of going back and forth as they're going through. So this is the prominent phenotype, and I'm not going to show you any of the other data, but we can quantify these. We can use lots of other methods to look at dendrites. We can stain for cytoskeletal proteins. We can use genetic labeling techniques. But you know, if you get this picture, you sort of get the idea of what's going on with the pyramidal cells. I'll skip the quantification. And relating it back to the idea of the sensitive period is if we think this is based on dopamine transmission, then the dopamine system needs to be here in this part of the tissue at this time, right? I mean, that's pretty logical. And so, in fact, that is the case. Tyrosine hydroxylase, again, is one of these enzymes crucial for dopamine synthesis. Again, rabbits have 30-day gestation. We think it's E16 to 25 is the sensitive period. So if we do staining for tyrosine hydroxylase at embryonic day 15 in the regions that it should be projecting to, this is the area that's going to become the striatum. This is the area that's going to become the cortex. We don't see very much labeling there. We see no labeling there. But just a few days later, I'll show you E22, but it's even before that, you see these fibers being labeled throughout the presumptive striatum as well as the presumptive cortex. So these are the presynaptic. You don't see cell bodies, right? They're back in the midbrain. You're seeing the tips of the projections, the terminals in this. So now they are established. Similarly, the receptors need to be there. So in this case, we're looking at mRNA transcript that will encode the dopamine D1 receptor. And again, at embryonic day 15, here, signal is white, not black. Background is black. So at E15, we see nothing. But at E22, the receptor's blazing in the beginning of the striatum. And it's also significantly expressed in the cerebral cortex. So the timing makes sense. And we've done a lot more experiments in the rabbits. And people have done a lot of experiments in mouse and human. And it all matches in terms of when these things are coming online. So what we see is that actually, if we administer prenatal cocaine at this stage, and in the earlier summary figure it was E8 to E15 is what I put in, we don't see any effects on any of the measures. And so it makes sense if it's operating through the dopamine system within the fetal brain, that's what we would expect. And that's an issue in these studies of prenatal cocaine because, again, it's a dirty drug. It could even be altering maternal circulation to the fetus. You might expect some fairly nonspecific effects, but we're seeing these very specific effects on the integrity of the developing dopamine system. One of the pieces of behavioral data I'll show, although it's currently unpublished, this was an experiment done by Barb Thompson, a postdoctoral fellow in Pat Levitt's group a few years ago. This was something that we never would have done if we hadn't come to Vanderbilt. The apparatus shop over in the Hobbs building has helped us I just can't imagine the number of ways, both in the mouse neurobehavioral core that Elizabeth mentioned, but you could imagine that not that many people are interested in doing behavior in rabbits. So, you know, when we have an open field for a mouse is about this big, an open field for a rabbit is 4 feet by 4 feet, so it's not exactly high throughput. But they've helped us with constructing a number of tasks that we can use for some simple behavioral screening. This is a case where Barb set up a conditioning experiment where there were two halves of an apparatus that looked different to the animals. And she repeatedly administered cocaine to the animal when they were being kept. There was a door between the two to one side of the apparatus, and then a saline vehicle on the other side of the apparatus. We call this condition place preference. Following repeated pairings of a stimulus in a certain environment, if it's a stimulus that the animal likes, then we can test them a few days later under drug-free conditions and monitor how much time they spend on one side of the chamber versus the other. And so, not surprisingly, if you pair a chamber with cocaine injection, the animal really learns to like that side, and they seek that side out if they're given a choice. We see a blunting of that, however, in the prenatal cocaine-exposed offspring. This is actually pretty important data because everyone in the clinical field has been very concerned about substance use patterns in these kids that were exposed to cocaine in utero. Would they actually be more likely to be drug seekers and to move in that direction? These data actually suggest the opposite, that they're less likely to go through. And we can talk about that during questions if you want. We have some ideas about what's going on. I'm going to skip that for the sake of time. But overall, what we see, let's just focus here. What we see in the animal model is a decreased rate of acquisition of complicated learning tasks. I didn't have time to show you these data, but these are great experiments done by the labs of John Harvey in Philadelphia and Mike Gabriel at the University of Illinois. When folks first started to look at the animal models of prenatal cocaine and they did very simple learning tasks, they saw nothing. And in fact, if they saw an effect, it was that the cocaine-exposed offspring learned faster and better. They were very, very simplistic paradigms. And to some degree, there is this thought that the exposure and the loss of D1 signaling may trigger the ability to sort of focus in on this one thing, but to a fault, because as soon as you make the paradigm more complicated, you now have to pay attention to this is a predictor, but this isn't. That's when you see deficits that come through, and that's very similar to what's being observed in the kids that are being tracked. I'm not going to show you the uncoupling data, but again, what it comes down to in terms of the cellular mechanism is this internalization of the dopamine D1 receptor. And what's particularly stunning about this finding is that it is permanent. I'm as close to permanent as I can say. It is long-lasting. I'm sometimes questioned in grant proposals, what do you mean it's permanent? Well, luckily I didn't run this experiment, but I convinced someone else to run an experiment where they did the prenatal cocaine treatment and then they housed the animals for 2 years and then went in and looked at the tissue, and I did some anatomy, and they did the biochemistry, and the D1 receptor, the reduction in D1 receptor coupling is still present 2 years later following this transient developmental insult. So I feel pretty comfortable saying it's permanent, and this is pretty revolutionary. So are the prenatal cocaine changes, I want to bring it back to the dopamine receptor, so are they actually related to this altered D1 receptor distribution? So I'll just briefly go through two sets of studies that we've done to look at that. The first is we moved into a mouse system. It's much easier to do genetics in mice, as most of you probably get. And in fact, we didn't even have to make this mouse ourselves. Someone else had already made it. So in D1 receptor knockout mice, we see very similar changes in the morphology of these apical dendrites. In this case, this is a stain for MAP2, a protein that specifically is expressed in neuronal cell bodies and dendrites. And in two regions of the forebrain, we see differences where you see these choppy segments in these knockout mice that normally are these straight soldiers lined up in a row. And again, we in this case, it's not dye labeling. We took advantage of genetics where we were able to put a reporter into some of these cells and then do imaging. So this YFP, yellow fluorescent protein that you see, is something that we've engineered in, but it shouldn't be altering anything in the morphology of the cells. So the pertinent thing is whether you're wild type or null at the D1 receptor locus. And again, you know, you see these straight apical dendrites. We're just looking at a subset of cells here. You know, if we were labeling every cell, it would just be green all the way through. But you can again see these very abnormally arranged processes. You know, in this case, it actually turns back around, and who knows what sort of connections it's making in that case. In contrast, studies by Fazal Lorraine, a neuroscience graduate student in my lab, suggests again, in terms of the specificity, D5 receptor knockout mice, the D5 is the receptor that's most similar to D1 and its properties, there's no alterations there, so we think it's really D1. We can also model some of this in vitro in a culture dish, and I'm just going to go through a couple of examples of it. The effects of dopamine receptors in development are very complicated. So we think this morphological difference is truly related to the loss of D1 signaling. And that's because if you just take normal control neurons derived from embryonic medial frontal cortex, grow them up in a dish under defined culture conditions, they're going to send some processes out, and we can measure those in vitro. And if we bath apply a D1 receptor agonist into these cortical neurons, we see a significant decrease in spontaneous neurite outgrowth. So in cortical neurons, the D1 receptor is essentially serving as a break for this. In the prenatal cocaine exposure, we've lost this D1, and therefore the dendrites are growing too fast, and we end up with these long, wavy processes. Make sense? In contrast, in striatal cultures, this other region I mentioned that receives a very dense dopaminergic innervation, we see the opposite effect of D1 agonists. In this case, it's the gas. So I was trying to think of some sort of relation to the Toyota recalls, but I guess we haven't, so it's not that Toyotas have lost their brakes, it's just, I guess they have too much gas, so it's not quite the same as what we get with prenatal cocaine, but it's that type of idea is the way that we think about it. So we can actually culture neurons from developing rabbits that were exposed in utero to cocaine. And in vitro, there's no additional treatment. They're treated identically. There's no cocaine in vitro. This is just mom was exposed either to control or to cocaine. We terminate that treatment around the peak of cortical differentiation, take the tissue out, grow it up in a dish. And in fact, we can recapitulate the changes that we see. We see this significant increase in neurite length in the anterior cingulate cortex, using MAP2 again in this case as a marker. I didn't have a chance to go into the regional differences. One of the reasons why we think this is truly dopamine mediated is we spent a lot of time looking at other brain regions. And other brain regions, like for example, the visual cortex, which receives a very dense serotonin projection, a dense norepinephrine projection, but virtually no dopamine. From the same tissue derived from the same animals, we see no effect. So what do we see in the striatum where we see that D1 is more of the gas? This is a different way of looking at the data. In this case, we're putting it as a histogram. So it's the percent of neurons with length greater than this. So in this case, In this case, we see the shift to the right indicative of the increased outgrowth in medial frontal cortex. In the striatal neurons, which tend to be shorter to begin with, we actually see a significant decrease in spontaneous neurite outgrowth. So we have a double dissociation of the growth changes that we're seeing across these cells. And so, yes, we're interested in this from the point of view of prenatal cocaine, but we're also very interested in this from a variety of other factors. You can imagine dozens, if not hundreds, of genetic and environmental factors that are going to alter the levels of dopamine or the dopamine receptor tone during these critical periods of development. And so that's what the laboratory is now focused on, is looking at these development stages. These developmental stages. I'm not even moving, man. Trying to pinpoint intracellularly, how does this direction change? What is it? What is it about how receptors interact with the dopamine signal? How it interacts with the I will switch mics. Can you just turn me off on this one? Thank you. How it is that dopamine receptors interact with their specific signaling pathways in these distinct brain regions to produce these very different effects on morphology. So with that, unfortunately, for Fazal and Ali in the back, I'm going to skip their new data. And I'm just going to go back to this classic, this is a modification of sort of a classic figure developed by Pat Goldman, Rakesh, and Amy Arnston some years ago. And this inverted U, in this case, we're using it for dopamine receptor levels. It's also used predominantly with norepinephrine regulation of cognition within the prefrontal cortex. But what it comes down to is these are modulatory systems. It's often not an all or none. And take Parkinson's disease again as an example. You need to have a very large decrease in total amount of dopamine before you can pick up significant behavioral changes in Parkinson's patients or in animal models. So it's not about the absolute level. What it appears to be about is the relative tone of the different systems. And so you can modulate this by either being too high or too low, and more specifically, it's often about the relative balance of what's going on in terms of the D1-like versus the D2-like receptors. So in the case of prenatal cocaine or D1 haploinsufficiency, we're talking about losing the D1 receptor expression or function and moving more into a D2-dominated state. And so then the idea is that, you know, and if the D1 simply aren't on the plasma membrane, maybe we can come up with ways to push them back out to the plasma membrane. But in the short term, the other way to modulate the system is to reestablish the balance by blocking what's going on in the D2 receptor. So it's a very simple-minded hypothesis. But by blocking these D2 receptors, we should be able to restore some balance with the neuromodulation. So these are the types of ideas and hypotheses that we're exploring. So there's a large group of people and collaborators that have contributed to this, and they're not even all listed on this slide. A lot of the data that I showed you today was derived from work of Ricardo Washington, a former, and Joshua Parliament, two fantastic former technicians of mine. Joshua has now gone on to med school at UT. Fazal is really moving on the culture studies that I just briefly went into. We think the D1 receptor effects are even more complicated. We think that D1 receptors can do very different things in terms of cell signaling depending on the actual protein complex that it's forming with other receptors. Aaliyah Frederick is an MSTP student in the lab working on the cell signaling pathways in collaboration with Roger Colburn's lab. Rest of the lab here, Pat Levitt and Barb Thompson were folks where we did a lot of this work collaboratively. Many collaborators at Vanderbilt and elsewhere. Most of the funding up until recently for everything that's been going on in the last couple of years has been provided directly from the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center, for which I am truly appreciative. And let's take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Bowman, I think that they want to give you a mic.
Okay. I was curious about the timing of when the D1 receptor is being internalized. Presumably some of the early actions are due to excessive signaling, given the
right.
buildup of dopamine, and just the balance there and what you know about it as of this moment.
Right. So at the time of the insult, we're giving cocaine to the pregnant mom. That's actually increasing the amount of dopamine that's in the synapse. So typically, what we know about receptor regulation is almost all derived from studies in adult animals or sometimes in heterologous cell systems. We actually don't know very much about what systems are in place developmentally to regulate it. It's a very important homeostatic function. Although I don't have great data on this, the model that I think about to explain it is we just sort of happen to come in during the sensitive period, give an injection of cocaine, and flood the system as the receptor has made it to the plasma membrane, basically for the first time. And many of these regulatory systems haven't yet been established. So it heads out to the plasma membrane. It gets flooded with this synaptic and extracellular dopamine. And it says, whoa, what's going on here? So typically what would happen is the receptor would be phosphorylated, it would be transiently internalized, and then the cell would eventually send some receptors back out to the surface to sense what's happening extracellularly. What we imagine is happening is that because those homeostatic systems haven't been established yet, and that's sort of the first or an early stage where it's sensing that, is this, for whatever reason, the neuron just never tries again. It just never sends the receptors back out. It just says, that's the norm. And I should point out, it's a hypomorphic phenotype, so we see an 80% reduction. So some of them do make it back out there, but it's dramatically lower. But for whatever reason, there isn't a good neuroadaptive strategy that can be employed by the nervous system at this stage to figure out that this was abnormal. So it thinks this is normal, so it doesn't want to have it out. So we know that the receptors are out there at this time. We know that we lose the signaling through the G protein signaling pathways immediately. We've looked very early with the treatments, and basically as soon as we can reliably immunoprecipitate the receptors and do the assays, the coupling is gone. So it's immediate in terms of that time. I don't really know why it mechanistically it's permanent, but those are sort of the ideas that we mull about in the lab. Jeremy?
So you have a really striking anatomic phenotype, and then you also have this striking change in the receptor. I wonder if there's a way to dissect out, or if you have an opinion on, which one of those is underlying the actual behavioral and cognitive phenotypes that you're observing both in the animals and in the kids. And then I've got a follow-up question.
So we think it's both. We think that the primary effect is this loss of signaling of the dopamine D1 receptor, and we think that produces the change in morphology. And then we think that particularly in the cortex with cognitive behaviors, we think that there's probably some still acute loss of D1 signaling that plays a role, but also alterations in that brain architecture that are contributing to that as well. And in the striatum, we think a lot of it's more acute loss of the dopamine receptor. So the strategies that we're considering to look at that are being able to go into mouse models with temporally specific regulation where we knock the receptor signaling down simply embryonically or simply in the adult, and then go in and look at what those phenotypes are and try to relate them. Similar to what Renee Henn and others have done in the serotonin system and anxiety behaviors.
So my follow-up question is, we use, albeit not cocaine, but we use methylphenidate and amphetamine to treat kids who have difficulty with hyperactivity and inattention. And some of your data would suggest that would be less effective in folks who had been prenatally exposed to cocaine. And then you even went on to say maybe atypical or typical antipsychotics would be more effective, which is interesting given prescribing trends. But one of the things I'm curious about is what actually happens when you give these cocaine reuptake blockers later in development, do you see a similar but transient change? Is this an example sort of like what we see with the SSRIs, or is this a completely different story?
So we haven't looked later in our model. Probably the best work, especially on methylphenidate, is work that Susan Anderson up in Boston has done. And she hasn't looked morphologically. She's looked behaviorally. And she does see some long-lasting changes in future sensitivity and in behavioral profiling following adolescent exposure to methylphenidate. Again, we don't have a good structural correlate for it. Sort of the other part that question sort of brings up is this idea of should we be differentiating children in the clinic based on this history? And that's actually something that that Levitt and I thought about trying to get off the ground about 3 or 4 years ago, didn't move forward. It's still a long-term direction for my lab, and I'd really like to look at this once I'm better established with the basic mechanisms. Our hypothesis is that there is a lot of, so the kids with prenatal substance abuse, it's not just cocaine, it's other drugs, it looks a lot like ADHD. However, it really, there aren't good studies on this, but talking to people that are studying these kids, it's a treatment-resistant ADHD. They actually don't respond well to Ritalin. In fact, then, because they run out of prescribing options, they'll put them on an antipsychotic, they'll do better, and then they'll go back and retroactively sort of label them as bipolar instead. So we can talk about why that's an issue, because, you know, that's an issue. But that's what sort of has led to this idea. So what we think might be going on in treatment-resistant ADHD is that, one, we may not want to go that route of stimulants in prenatal drug-exposed populations. But two, even apart from prenatal drug exposure, I bet within treatment-resistant ADHD, there is a group where what they share are complex, rare mutations, not necessarily in the dopamine D1 receptor itself, but along that signaling pathway. So we're interested in collaborating with folks, and I've talked to some people in child psychiatry here, we're interested in collaborating with folks to get specifically treatment-resistant ADHD with an absence of history of prenatal drug exposure. And we want to do some mapping of DNA sequences in the receptors and in the direct downstream to see if we can put this together in a genetic pathway. So we should talk more about that, Jeremy.